Little Fictions, the incredible new album. Elbow, Little Fictions, available now.
The Guardian.
Hi, Ian Sample here. Before you get started with this edition of Science Weekly, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
In general, we look for new law by the following process. First, we guess it. Then we... Well, don't laugh. That's the really true. Then we compute the consequences of the guess to see what, if this is right, if this law that we guessed is right, we see what it would imply. And then we compare those computation results to nature. Or we say compare to experiment or experience.
The 20th century was a golden one for science. Big Bang cosmology gave us the best theory we have for the beginning of the universe. For the first time, scientists unraveled the genetic code of life. And of course, Einstein came up with a new framework for gravity and space-time with his general theory of relativity.
If it disagrees with experiment, it's wrong. In that simple statement is the key to science. It doesn't make a difference how beautiful your guess is. It doesn't make a difference how smart you are who made the guess or what his name is. If it disagrees with experiment, it's wrong. That's all there is to it.
But the 20th century also saw the birth of quantum mechanics, a description of the world on a subatomic level. Unlike many of the other great achievements of the century, the weird world of quantum physics remains as mysterious today as it was a century ago. In the quantum world, particles can be in two places at once. They can interact over vast distances in an instant. They can even change their behavior depending on whether or not they're being watched. You get none of that in the world of classical physics we're used to.
The thing that's exciting about this is that nature is strange as it can be, in this sense, that the rules that are going to be obeyed, that I'm going to tell you about, by which this stuff is analyzed, by which we understand nature, the rules of the checkers, yeah, are so screwy, you can't believe them.
But what if strange quantum behavior emerged from familiar classical physics? How would this alter our view of the quantum world? And more importantly, what would it tell us about the fundamental nature of reality?
We go ahead with Gerard. Are we talking to you on a cell phone or a landline?
No, this is a fixed telephone.
Are you okay to?
I'm Ian Sample. You on that line? This is Science Weekly.
Okay, wonderful. Okay.
Before we get into the nitty-gritty of what some people call emergent quantum mechanics, let's look at how the worlds of quantum physics and classical physics differ.
Can I ask you to kick off by...
To find out, I put the question to Gerard Tuft, the Nobel Prize winner and Emeritus Professor of Theoretical Physics at Utrecht University in the Netherlands.
Yes, quantum physics, quantum mechanics, we say, I still regard, and I think many will agree with me, as this is one of the most important scientific discoveries of the 20th century. It is a discovery that tiny particles such as atoms and molecules or electrons, quanta of light, all these things behave in a way fundamentally different from what one would expect in a theory where they are described classically. In a sense, particles can be regarded like tennis balls or soccer balls or planets or stars as just objects moving around in space, rotating while they move, and when they collide, they interact. So far, so good. But when you want to describe the details of what's actually happening, you need this fundamental new doctrine called quantum mechanics, where the mechanical laws are not very much, they don't sound very much similar to the old classical theories of Newton and others in the past centuries who perfectly well understood how gravitational forces act on large objects such as stars and planets, or apples falling down from an apple tree. We all understand those forces very well, but when it comes to tiny particles, it is fundamentally different. And not only the description of a force is different, but also the kinematics. How does a particle react when a force is acted upon it?
But the behavior of particles, the behavior at the quantum level is weird. We can agree that much.
Yes. But it is extremely coherent and internally logical. So we can't say that there's anything wrong with the theory. Quite the contrary, it's quite unique. And the very special feature of quantum mechanics is that when you have a particle that is very small and described by quantum mechanical laws, these laws are very unique and very well described now. We have beautiful, beautiful mathematical equations to describe what actually happens. But the result of those equations is that more often than not, a particle, it cannot be exactly predicted. It might sometimes move in this direction, sometimes in that direction. Sometimes it spins in such a way, sometimes it spins in another way. And we cannot completely predict how it will spin or how it will move, but predictions that it can give are usually statistical in nature. So many percent of the particles will do this, another percentage of particles will do that, and some will undergo changes when they collide against other particles, and sometimes they don't. All this is statistically distributed, but in a very systematic way and controlled by very precisely defined equations.
Were these two theories, quantum physics and classical physics, were they thought to be incompatible descriptions of the world, or i.e. almost separate ways of describing reality?
I wouldn't say incompatible. It's rather that classical physics has been, well, derated as an approximate way of describing things as soon as something is large. If you have one particle, it's quantum mechanical. But if you have 1,000 particles together in a bigger unit, then these conglomerations of larger numbers of particles start to behave more and more in agreement with what we always thought classically. So classical physics is a physics where the strange effects in quantum mechanics are getting more and more difficult to see. As soon as you look at a larger object, then it in all respects behaves classically. And there's nothing wrong with that. It stays that way, except when you want to be either very, very precise or you want to consider very tiny particles. Then we have the new laws. So it's not so that quantum mechanics is in disagreement with classical physics, but that quantum mechanics takes over the classical description whenever something becomes very tiny and very light and very small.
So while they're not incompatible as such, it's obvious that the quantum and classical worlds are very different places. It's baffled the best of us, including Albert Einstein, who famously proclaimed that God did not play dice. And this all comes back to something known as the measurement problem.
There's a problem at the heart of quantum mechanics that's usually known as the measurement problem.
This is Eleanor Knox.
My name's Eleanor Knox, and I'm a lecturer at King's College London.
I spoke to Eleanor via Skype this week, and as she explains...
Effectively, what it means is that the formalism of quantum mechanics describes the states of different systems evolving in a certain kind of way under a certain kind of law. And then all of a sudden, when we perform a measurement, we use some different kinds of physics, some probabilistic physics that assigns probabilities to outcomes. And that's very different from physics we've seen before. And it was hugely puzzling to the fathers of quantum mechanics. And there was quite a lot of debate about what the kind of the reality behind quantum mechanics might be when quantum mechanics was first proposed, something that bothered Einstein enormously. But then something rather odd happened in the kind of first half of the 20th century, which was more or less that there was an agreement that people would stop worrying about the measurement problem. They called that agreement the Copenhagen interpretation, but it's not really an interpretation. It's more a kind of quietism about what to do about quantum mechanics. And that kind of continues throughout the 20th century with some notable exceptions and people who remain very worried about what it is that quantum mechanics is really describing. And then I think one very positive development in the relatively recent past has been that it's become a bit more respectable again to worry about the foundations of quantum mechanics, to worry about what it really means.
How does having an emergent quantum mechanics solve the problem then, Eleanor?
Okay, so what we mean by an emergent theory is a kind of non-fundamental theory. So presumably there are all kinds of bits of science that we don't think are in the kind of the smallest, most basic level of reality. You know, you might think biology is very interesting, very, very important, but it's not in there at the kind of the smallest level of physics. Likewise, we have theories like thermodynamics that describes thermal stuff. It describes, you know, pressure and volume and temperature. And these aren't things we think are there in the most basic level of reality. We have very good physics that governs those quantities, and they're very, very useful. And they're perfectly real in the sense that, you know, they're just as real as tables and chairs and people and things, but they're not fundamental. Now, if quantum mechanics were like that, the thought goes, perhaps we might be able to get around some of the problems in the measurement problem. And this is why. So the thought is that quantum mechanics has these probabilities, and they seem to sort of suddenly crop up when we do measurements. Now, if those probabilities were like the probabilities you get when you, say, toss a coin, they would be much less mysterious. So you might think that, you know, what's going on when I toss a coin? Well, you might think that the real physics is deterministic. We could debate whether that's true. So the real physics is all kind of perfectly determined. There's no real probabilities in it. But when I toss a coin, I give a 50-50 probability of heads or tails because I don't know what the exact conditions of the coin are. So it's not terribly surprising that when I toss a coin, I have a probability before I toss the coin and then something definite after I toss the coin, because what I've done is just got some information about the system that I didn't have before. If quantum mechanics was emergent, like, say, thermodynamics, we could perhaps think of the probability in quantum mechanics like that. We could think of the system as having had a definite state that always told us what was going to happen after measurements, and we just found out what that definite state was on measurement.
The Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics is still very popular with physicists, but Tuft is one of those who favours an emergent theory. I asked him where this idea first came from.
Well, the equations are very precise, and when you look at the outcome of a calculation, you would say, well, that's exactly what you also would expect a classical system to do. After all, if you play soccer or you play tennis, sometimes the tennis ball goes in this direction, sometimes it goes in that direction. Often you can't predict that with infinite accuracy. When you shoot the ball to make a goal, it might sometimes miss, it might sometimes get right in the middle. Of course, in classical physics, we also have statistical, we call it stochastic behavior. So there's nothing new. So why, just because the equations look different, why should the underlying philosophy of quantum mechanics be so different from the classical theory? And I can tell you right now that the easiest way to understand how the equations work is, yes, you have to regard the whole scheme as fundamentally different from classical physics. But the question is, maybe this is an optical illusion. Maybe the underlying physics is the same, but we haven't understood exactly what it is that is moving. And of course, in the beginning of the theory, and it was in the 1920s that the theory started to gain shape. In the beginning, most people thought that way, that they said, well, the equations look different, but maybe that's just because we haven't understood the details very well of what actually is going on. In particular, Einstein thought that, and he went into the discussions with many of his colleagues. But then the answer to that was no, you can't get away with that. It's not a quantum particle is not just a somewhat crazy moving thing in the universe. It's more fundamentally different. It's different all the way to its bones. You can't write a classical theory that substitutes the quantum equations. And the more and more people did experiments, and the theory grew from originally being a bunch of wild ideas into a very sound mathematical scheme, the more people got convinced, no, it's fundamental, this difference. It's not just the fact that that you can't find a good classical model that explains all this. No, the logic is different, even at its most fundamental bones. No matter how deep you dig into the nature of things, you will find that quantum mechanics is not like the classical theory. And that view has become more and more commonly accepted because it works. In practice, this is the best way to deal with the situation if you want to do any calculation. And now we have what we call the standard model of the subatomic particles. That is to say, we have a list of all particles that can routinely be produced in processes where very tiny particles collide against each other. And we know exactly how these particles interact. It all goes with the laws of quantum mechanics, and it works. So we call that the standard model. And so most people who work with these ideas in practice say, well, that is it. We don't need any more, anything else to do to understand how nature works. So we're happy with that.
But is quantum theory a fundamental description of nature? Gerard, for one, isn't so sure.
It's a little bit mysterious. And as a scientist, I'm not the only one who says, well, we don't like mystery in our field. We don't want to have a kind of a religious undertone in our description of things. We are rational people. We want to understand things in terms of very, very ordinary internal logic. Whereas there's a tendency of some people to say, no, we have to do away with internal logic as the way we're used to it. We have to replace that by what we call quantum logic.
Do you think this quantum behavior could be an optical illusion, as you put it?
I think it is, but not so much an illusion because it works. So I say, yes, of course, these laws are correct, and the way we compute behavior of subatomic particles is the only correct way to compute that. That I fully accept because I see that every day in my work, how well it works. But the question really is, what are we doing here? Is it actually that we are describing? And it is here that, well, my fantasy is a little bit wilder than most other people. The least thing I want to do is to change the theory, to change the laws, how to produce, how to calculate something. So I know that the quantum laws, as they are all now in the books, are basically correct. I say, no, these laws, I take them for to be absolutely true. There's no point with changing the mathematics. Some of my friends want to do that. They just want to say, well, the equations are only approximately true. If you change them a little bit, then you can understand how it can have a classical origin. And my attitude is, no, that's not the kind of theory I'm looking for. I don't think that's going to work. So I'm looking for a theory that in a completely natural way tells me that, yes, there's something vibrating here. It's not a particle. It's not a wave. It's not a field. It's something different. And the best thing it looks like is what we call a cellular automaton. That's a more or less like the chips in your laptop. These chips are interacting with other chips, and they're doing things classically. What happens in a computer today is still completely classical physics. So it's a little bit like that, but exactly how to describe it is still very difficult. But I think there is still possibilities.
So a lot of physicists just get on and calculate and assume that quantum mechanics is fundamental. Something I wanted to know is how controversial these emergent theories are. Is that itself controversial, or is it just the manner in which it happens, the manner in which that may come about that's controversial?
No, the idea that this could be true is controversial because very ingenious general ideas have been brought up. There's a famous Bell inequalities, named after John Bell at the time, who claim to show, to prove that it is fundamentally impossible to have a classical explanation of quantum mechanics. So, for instance, to imitate a quantum particle in a classical computer is fundamentally impossible. And there are very sound arguments for that, except, and that is what I'm not the only one to observe this, there is some small print. And it is here where I have my question marks. And there's a bunch of other people who say the same things in different ways. So, for instance, things get more complicated if you assume that everything in this world is correlated. So things that are happening here in Holland, happening in England, or happening anywhere else in the world or in the universe, they're all correlated. So they're not independent. So quantum mechanics seems to suggest that a particle moving here and a particle moving anywhere else, that they don't behave independently. They behave in a collective sort of way. And this sounds awkward, and some people say, well, that sounds like conspiracy. How does this electron here know what that electron there is doing? My answer is that it doesn't, but the laws of nature are such that when this particle does this, the other particle is more likely to do this than to do that or than to do that. So particles, no matter how far away they are from each other, they are linked, they are correlated. And this correlation should have a natural explanation. It's not a mystical thing. It's not something that is fundamentally inexplicable. No, it is a natural consequence of a very special law of nature. You see this, for instance, if you put two laptops together and you run the same program on two laptops, then whatever these electrons are doing in both laptops is correlated, is related. If one laptop does something, you can bet on it that the other laptop will do something very similar at that very same moment. So things that are happening in different parts of the universe are correlated just because of the nature of the physical laws that they are obeying, while these physical laws themselves could be non-quantum mechanical.
So does that mean that this spooky action at a distance that Einstein worried about,
yes,
doesn't need to be so much of a problem, because the fact that two particles may be correlated in some way may have some historical explanation rather than requiring some superluminal communication between them?
Yeah, there are many examples of situations in physics where things can be correlated at different spots in space and time without the need of any signal going faster than light from one to the other. And this is where the opinions diverge and where there's some controversy, some discussion as to whether you can realize a model in mathematical terms where you can explain the very peculiar kind of correlations that Bell discovered and that would not be possible to describe classically in a standard classical theory.
This is one of the most controversial aspects of theories like TUF's, something Eleanor Knox calls superdeterminism. It means that the spooky action at a distance that we see in quantum mechanics comes from predetermined correlations. After this short break, we'll hear more about Gerard's objections to what he calls quantum logic.
So the real world is not described as if it's a single universe, but it is a very, very large collection of different universes, which are, some of them are being more probable than others, and altogether they form our universe as it is. And I find this picture, well, unsatisfactory.
And we'll hear from another physicist who has his own perspective on quantum mechanics.
I like a perspective on quantum mechanics which is called relational quantum mechanics. It's a way of viewing quantum mechanics, which in a sense is the opposite of those attempts. Namely, it...
We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Jason Phipps here, ruler of all things podcast here at The Guardian. Just to let you know that this episode is sponsored by the good people at Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Before we kick off again, I wanted to point you in the direction of a new podcast by The Guardian team called Brexit Means. An in-depth look at all things Brexit, it's hosted by The Guardian's European Affairs correspondent, John Henley. So far, the podcast has looked at what Brexit means in light of the Supreme Court decision on triggering Article 50, what it means for EU citizens living in the UK, and in the most recent episode, what it means for the UK's financial services sector.
We're going to see a hiatus of pretty much uncertainty for the next couple of years, maybe longer, 3, 4, 5 years.
To subscribe to Brexit Means, head to theguardian.com/podcasts or get it on your favourite podcast app.
You see, one thing is I can live with doubt and uncertainty and not knowing. I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than to have answers which might be wrong.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. Before the break, we heard about Professor Gerard Tufte's emergent theory of quantum mechanics. It's a theory that has quantum mechanics grounded in good old run-of-the-mill classical physics. But something I was interested in is, why does the mathematics of quantum physics work so well, and it works brilliantly, if it isn't describing something accurately?
Well, that is what most people claim. They say, well, let's do away with classical physics altogether and let's assume that the quantum world is, for always at all times, the world that we live in. And let's not try to tamper with that. And that makes a lot of sense. And that's also what we tell our students, that, you know, you might not believe this, but let's accept it for a moment the way this theory is. It works. So stop asking questions. And that's also the big lesson that people like Niels Bohr taught us in the beginning of the 20th century. Don't ask too many questions at once, because you won't get any answers. Whereas without asking these questions, your theory works just as well. So that was a positive attitude that made us accept the theory, except that, yeah, the internal logic requires, in a sense, that all universes, where everything happens in all possible ways, are, in a sense, equally real. They describe the real world as it is. So the real world is not described as if it's a single universe, but it is a very, very large collection of different universes, which are, some of them are being more probable than others, and altogether they form our universe as it is. And I find this picture, well, unsatisfactory. But if you say it this way, then certainly you don't need to ask any further questions, and you can do all your calculations and it works.
As Gerard mentioned in the first half of the show, his kind of approach is still pretty controversial in the world of physics.
Hello.
Oh, hi, is that Carlo?
Yeah, that's me, hi.
This is Carlo Rovelli.
I work in the University of Aix-Marseille. I'm a professor of physics.
I spoke to Carlo this week via Skype and asked him what he thinks about emergent theories of quantum mechanics.
Quantum mechanics is clearly extremely weird, and we are all a little bit puzzled by it. So all the attempts to get some clarity about it are good, I think. And trying to see to which extent we can make it emerge from a sort of classical, non-weird theory, it's a worthwhile enterprise, I think. I myself think that it's more likely that ultimately we will have to get used to quantum mechanics rather than trying to eliminate its weirdness.
But what about these emergent theories of quantum mechanics? What are their strengths and weaknesses?
The strength is exactly the attempt to avoid the fact that quantum mechanics is so strange. So the strength is the simplicity. I mean, having a theory that makes sense conceptually doesn't force us to sort of change our philosophy about the world. The weakness, I think, is that one judges a theory by its ability to predict new things, but even more by its being fruitful. So far, these theories haven't been fruitful. They haven't led to new physics, to new ways of thinking, which doesn't mean that they're not going to do that in the future, but the question is very much open. So I guess the weakness is, if we replace this strange theory with a construction that ends up being a bit baroque, too much stuff which we cannot test and doesn't give us good physics, is it worthwhile? Isn't it better perhaps to just accept the strangeness as a feature of the world, something that we can think as a feature of the world?
Drawing it back to Gerard's own theory, It's this kind of acceptance without understanding that makes Gerard so uncomfortable. Gerard, I would imagine it would be uncomfortable for a lot of physicists to be told, look, you don't need to know how this works. You can see it works from the calculations. Just get on with it. That doesn't sound a very satisfying thing in terms of physicists I've spoken to.
But there's also a large group of people who say, well, wait a minute. If you consider all possible universes at all times, then mathematically speaking, they form a bigger conglomeration of things that we call a super universe or a multiverse, it's called. All universes together form not a universe, but a multiverse. And you can deal with quantum mechanics by saying our world is not a universe, it's a multiverse. And for every spot in the universe, which means a different universe, has attached to it what you call a quantum amplitude. That amplitude tells you to what extent that universe is realized. And then if you want to know the behavior of all these multiverses, you have to take the whole grand total. You shouldn't consider one single universe. You take the grand total of all universes, and then you get what they call the many-world interpretation of quantum mechanics. And again, that works, but I find it unsatisfactory as being an enormous enlargement of our universe only because little particles behave so strangely. And that, to me, is again, unsatisfactory, but many people say, well, again, it works, so why bother? Well, what's your problem? That's what many people say.
What do you make of that attitude?
Well, it's sensible, except that it makes our universe tremendously or infinitely much more complicated than it could be. And I'm saying, wait a minute, we could turn things around. We could say that actually our description of the universe is like it is a multiverse because we don't know the true description. Since we have not yet a theory of how the universe works exactly, the only theory we've got is a theory where all possibilities are realized to some extent. That's called this multiverse. And when you take that multiverse, it works. But the fact that our universe is only one of them it doesn't seem to work until you turn it around. There is one universe, but we have this multiverse of descriptions of it. When we call something an elementary particle, it isn't a single particle. That is a template, as it were, of very, very many different possible universes. So the particles we talk about are actually not particles. They are templates. They are representing all sorts of possibilities. So the picture I have is that there are two equations describing two things, not just a multiverse, not a quantum amplitude, anything like that, but just two real identities. But we don't know what they are. And all we've got today are templates of electrons, of protons, or all the other particles, each of these templates being actually a vast collection of all possible universes. That doesn't mean that the real universe is like that. It means our description is like that.
So according to Gerard, while the mathematics of quantum mechanics works, it might not describe what we think it does. But Gerard isn't the only physicist with an alternative view of quantum.
I like a perspective on quantum mechanics, which is called relational quantum mechanics.
Carlo Rovelli again.
Which in a sense is the opposite of those attempts. Namely, it just takes quantum mechanics as, the best description of the world we have found so far, which of course doesn't mean it's the ultimate one, but it's the best we have. And then is an attempt to take it seriously and say, well, if the world is this way, what does it mean? This view of quantum mechanics, that relational quantum mechanics, is to take the theory at face value. What it says, take it seriously. And what it says is that the properties of all physical objects are not just properties of this object. They're always relative to something else, relational with respect to some other physical object. The quintessential example of that is velocity, right? No object has a velocity by itself. Velocity with respect to. Velocity with respect to the Earth is different than our velocity with respect to the train on which we are sitting or with respect to the sun. So velocity is not a property of an object. It's a property of an object relatively to something else. Well, it seems to me that if we accept that all quantities are like that, namely that when we talk about the world, we always talk about the world in the perspective of some physical system, some observer in some sense, then quantum mechanics is not weird anymore. But on the other hand, we have to give up the naive idea that things are in a certain manner, even alone, independently of anything else.
So where does that approach get us, though? What does that achieve?
I think that, as I said, what is important foundational question in physics is that they should be fruitful. So we have physical open problems in the basis of a current understanding of the world. We don't understand the quantum theory of gravity. So if we want to do a quantum gravity, we need a way to think about quantum mechanics in particular, which is one of the ingredients of quantum gravity. And so we need a way of thinking quantum mechanics such that it could help us construct a quantum theory of gravity. And I hope that a relational way like this one, I think it could be the right track. In other words, as long as we just look at atoms and electrons, it's only a way of viewing the same equations that we have already. However, it's a way that can be generalized to the quantum theory of space-time, so it's a way that becomes fruitful.
But whether it's relational quantum mechanics, emergent quantum mechanics, or just plain old quantum mechanics, as explained by Carlo, it's all part of our quest for an ultimate understanding of reality.
The history of science is a long sequence of discovering that our intuition is wrong, right? The Earth is not flat and we are not still, sort of move, the Earth moves, simultaneity is not well-defined, space is not flat, time goes fast in some region and slow somewhere else. So we keep discovering that the world is different. Now, if we end up agreeing that, well, quantum mechanics is just telling us how the world is, then this has even philosophical consequences. So a sort of naive realism, it's not viable anymore, and we have to accept that the reality is really funny, which I think will ultimately be the case.
Special thanks this week to Gerard Tuft, Eleanor Knox, and Carlo Rovelli. If you want to know more, we'll include links to Gerard's paper on emergent quantum mechanics and to Carlo's latest book, Reality is Not What It Seems, in the episode description on the Guardian website. I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.